politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen standing at the ready to fight anew for our life, our liberty, and our property, and actually mean it. Here at CR Podcast, your host, Daniel Horowitz, back here today for the first full day of spring, when we try to look forward towards growth, cheery times. But sadly, we don't have a movement looking forward. We don't have a party looking forward. Even though we have people that recognize all these existential crises, and they'll talk about it, they'll meme about it, they'll grift about it. But on this day, March 20th, 1942, General Douglas MacArthur was forced to retreat from the Philippines, and he famously vowed in a speech in Australia, "I shall return." And he did, because he understood the problem, understood what ought to be done. Men who understand the times and what ought to be done, that's what we need. But instead, we don't have it. You know, Proverbs 4:25, "Let your eyes look directly ahead, and let your gaze be fixed straight in front of you. Watch the path of your feet, and all your ways will be established. But do not turn right or left. Turn your foot from evil." And all we have are distractions, the few things that actually matter, okay? We have judicial supremacism. We have the border invasion and inflation, all this stuff. We have the ability of states to block. We have the federal house budget bill, and we have down the ballot primaries. And today's news kind of brings this all together, that on each front, we're undermining, subversive, failing, and not focusing on it. So there's no chance, and I could prove it to you, that anything will change. I could literally prove you to you the way we go about doing primaries, the way we go about Trump's endorsements, the way we go about Trump's focus and image and personnel and policies, the way we go about budget fights would persist even if he would win, which increasingly, you know, you're seeing that polling bubble was a little bit of an aberration. It's going back, but that's neither here nor there. And this is going to continue. Remember, if you can't have a budget fight today, you're not going to have it with the GOP in control of all three branches when Trump's scared of it. And Democrats will have more than ample power to block. So what is the answer? Nobody has explained to me what is the answer. And that's the question I asked you yesterday when I said if we're going to accede to judicial supremacism but not try to get Congress to at least then authorize the states to enforce or the states to mobilize in critical mass politically as a get-off-the-lawn sign to the courts, which I want to delve into, then what is the solution? Now, yesterday was a wild day with the courts on this SB4, the immigration enforcement of Texas. And there's a lot of confusion about what did and didn't happen. It looked like almost like yesterday's show was in vain, that the Supreme Court in the end took off the injunction. But then, actually, they did even worse. The insidious nature of what Barrett and Kavanaugh did yesterday is a clear sign that they are never going to rule with us, by the way, on the merits of state enforcement, not unless we do something like having the House write a budget provision that allows states to enforce, which they're not going to do, and they're already selling us out. And or the states just mobilizing together and saying, this is what we're doing. And it also demonstrates that Barrett and Kavanaugh are going to continue to play this shadow docket double game of not taking up our appeals, but then taking up left-wing appeals and often undermining and overturning the few good lower court decisions we secure, like in places like Texas. So I want to unpack all of this. We're going to start off with the courts, ties into immigration. Then we'll discuss the other two halves, the Ohio-Illinois primaries last night, as well as the budget bill that they're going to vote on Friday and no one even cares, knows Trump's not opposing it. He's actually supporting it quietly. And there's no inkling that we're ever even trying to change this. So you tell me what we're doing here, because I don't know. So anyway, let's start from the beginning procedurally, what happened with this thing. So Texas passes SB 4, okay? SB 4 basically allows the state to automatically issue a citation to anyone who comes over the border that's now a state crime to come over the border illegally, and you know they have to show up in court, and basically they could be hit up for a felony unless they agree to be deported, and Texas DPS would walk them to the border and kind of let them do their thing from there. By the way, it's not clear they would even go over, and they might throw themselves at DHS and not come back. That's a whole nother thing. If we have time, I'll get into SB4. SB4, the way it's written in a state like Texas, other states it would actually be useful, but in a state like Texas, you actually just need to deport the people who are coming over. You need to push them back. Anything short of that, you're not going to have enough jail space to deal with it, whatever. But the point is, legally, it opens the door to establish that states could enforce immigration law. So in that sense, it's important. So, you know, like I noted, if we're going to do anything, we're going to have states enforce. Anything short of that is yesterday's issue. We're long past any other solution. So this is probably the most vital legal issue, the ability of a state to defend itself against an invasion. In comes a liberal district judge, which there seem to be many in Texas, and the left always seems to be able to draw them on numerous issues, on the abortion pill stuff, on some of the tranny bills, and they get an immediate injunction on the law. And that's what happened. The district court put an injunction. And this is important to remember. It's a liberal district judge that screwed with the law first. Okay, it wasn't that a conservative panel kind of did something, you know, away from the status quo. It was a liberal district judge. And by the way, it's very clear, not just that at an injunctive level, that you're more likely to succeed on the merits, but 100%, he didn't have the trial yet on the merits, but he would 100% rule against the state on the merits. It was a 125-page opinion that absolutely states cannot enforce immigration law. Okay. Texas appeals, Ken Paxton appeals to the Fifth Circuit, which generally has been a lot more conservative. They did not draw a great panel like you're going to see in a minute. It's a Trump appointee, maybe a Bush appointee, and a Clinton appointee. And the Trump appointee, Oderholm, is the only good one on that panel. And but so they issue a temporary stay on the injunction. So let's not get confused here. It's a stay on the injunction. In other words, no, pending, you know, the process, we could go and you could go and start enforcing SB4. Now, before we go on, just in order to understand this, I'm just want to explain. There's a legal nuance between a temporary administrative stay on a lower court injunction and a more of a full, robust stay, what's called pending appeal. So there's really three levels. There's, you know, the Fifth Circuit ruling with us on the merits, which they certainly didn't do because even the district court didn't get to the merits yet, so there's nothing to appeal. That's the most robust. You side with someone on the merits. And then there's, okay, no, we're going to put a stay on the injunction, so we side with you that you could enforce it pending the appeals process. And then there's something even less, which is just a temporary administrative stay. That it's just, look, you know, we're kind of going through, you know, in other words, they were going to have a hearing, not on the merits even, but just, again, on the injunctive level appeal of the district court, already April 3rd. It's like, look, you know, this is happening very quickly. Let's just keep the status quo. So that's even less. Okay, they're not siding with the state that, you know, no, I fundamentally disagree with the district court that you didn't meet the threshold for an injunction. You're not even saying that. You're just saying, look, this is happening very quick. We're going to hear it. So let's just keep the status quo in place. Okay, that's what a temporary administrative stay is. It's really not saying a lot. In comes the Supreme Court and first puts, you know, an injunction on the stay of the injunction. In other words, sides with the liberal judge over the Fifth Circuit and says, no, actually, pending the Biden administration's appeal, we're going to go and, you know, put, you know, not allow the law to take effect for another week. Then they extended another week. Then that led to 2 days ago on Monday, they said, you know what? Indefinitely, we're staying it. And that's when we went to town yesterday. What the heck? And then yesterday, they come and say, actually, 6-3 ruling, that actually, Texas's law could go into effect. Wow. Amazing. So at least they sided with the Fifth Circuit, and that's great and awesome. And maybe everything I said yesterday was in vain. Well, obviously, actually, it wasn't because we have all these other bad cases I was talking about. But at least on this case, it's great. It can go through. But actually, if you look carefully what they said and what the result is, it reveals something very insidious that we're actually losing even on the injunctive level. We're certainly going to lose on the merits level of SB4. And frankly, it shows something very concerning about, in general, the way Kavanaugh and Barrett are headed on a lot of issues. But at the same time, it opens up the door. There is a little bit of good news, a window, that now is the time to flood the zone that the red states emphatically need to start passing similar laws, actually more robust laws on this and other things, both to solve the immigration issue, but also to preempt judicial tyranny, as we talked about yesterday. And then, of course, there's all the bigger need for the House Republicans to block the budget bill until states' rights to deal with the invasion are affirmed. But, of course, they're not doing that. So we're going to unpack this. First, our sponsor today, and I'm sorry I'm just speaking so quickly. There's so much to get to. Patriot Mobile. Again, you know, you don't need to go to a judge. You are the judge over voting with your pocketbook over what you choose to spend your money on. Well, I guess except when the Supreme Court says you have to purchase health insurance. But in general, you could choose who you want to purchase from. We've been proud sponsors, partners with Patriot Mobile, America's only Christian conservative wireless provider for 10 years here at The Blaze. It's this simple. You get the same number, same service, same, you know, scope of coverage, and except they actually use some of their money to give to conservative legal defense, political causes, rather than the other three major networks working with the deep state to spy on us, working with China and funding woke leftist crap. Go to patriotmobile.com/CR or call 972-PATRIOT today. The great thing is they're all English-speaking American citizens that you'll speak to. Get free activation when you use offer code CR. Again, patriotmobile.com/CR or call 972-PATRIOT. There is no excuse to continue funding those who hate you. So what happened was everyone was euphoric. Oh my gosh, the Supreme Court went ahead and took away the original injunction, and they're siding with the Fifth Circuit. But right away I knew something was funny. Just first of all, to reverse within 24 hours it was really bizarre. So you go from, you know, kind of an indefinite injunction to fully taking off the injunction so Texas couldn't force it. And then also I noticed right away that it was 6-3. And I was like, okay, there's something funny there. There's one thing if you peel off like, so it appears like we probably have Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. So, okay, maybe you peel off one of the three remaining GOP appointees. But to get all three, including Roberts, I was like, there's something really funny because there's no way they're going to let this go into effect. And then I saw that Amy Barrett wrote a concurrence and it was joined by Kavanaugh, which means certainly Roberts agrees with it. And it was a little bit funny. And they basically said the following. look, this is just a temporary administrative stay. The Fifth Circuit is not issuing more of a long-term stay on the injunction. It's just pending their to just kind of get a handle on their docket, hear the cases, so they want to keep the status quo. Generally speaking, we never, as the Supreme Court, overturn temporary administrative stays of an appellate court, which actually is not true because the Supreme Court has kind of been doing that to the conservative rulings at the Fifth Circuit for a while. And a lot of people from all ideologies have called out Barrett for that. It's kind of inaccurate and bizarre, but this is all part of the bizarre double game. But she's very process-wise. We tend not to do this. But then towards the end, basically winks and nods to the Fifth Circuit and is like, well, you know, Fifth Circuit, it would be a shame to lose your temporary administrative stay. You sure would not want this to turn into something permanent, right? This is really only temporary, right? And basically invited the Biden administration to come back and go and ask for a permanent injunction on their stay if this keeps up. And for background, this is part of the Biden administration's argument in their briefs before the court, because the Biden administration has been saying that, look, you know, the conservative Fifth Circuit is just kind of like, you know, playing around with temporary administrative stays, but they wind up staying there long term. And by the way, on some cases, the Biden administration is not wrong in that assertion, but the Fifth Circuit is correct. Because let's not forget, it's not the Fifth Circuit wading in. It's these liberal district judges that the Biden admin shops around to put an injunction on totally lawful actions of the Texas legislature. So the Fifth Circuit is right, would be right to put a permanent injunction on it, and they should. But they're like bothered by that they're using what's called a temporary administrative stay to really kind of make it de facto long-term and allow the state to go on and implement their laws. So let me just explain to you the consequences in the language of Amy Howe, writing for SCOTUS blog. Barrett acknowledged the Biden administration's suggestion that the Fifth Circuit has permitted these kinds of temporary stays to linger for so long that they effectively act as stays while the appeal is being litigated. Although the Supreme Court may have to address the question at some point, Barrett conceded, it does not need to do so now. Before this court intervenes, quote, before this court intervenes on the emergency docket, the Fifth Circuit should be the first mover. Wink nod, she concluded. Barrett indicated that the Court of Appeals presumably can act promptly. But if it does not, she posited, the Biden administration can always return to the Supreme Court to seek relief. Well, within a few hours, the Fifth Circuit moved up the hearing, and the Fifth Circuit themselves took away their stay, meaning allowing the lower court injunction to remain, meaning Texas can't enforce SB4. And again, of course they can, and they should. I'm speaking in, you know, modern day legal parlance as if courts are supreme, even when they're constitutionally abhorrent, but that's what it is. So the status quo is we're back to where we thought we were yesterday, but then we thought we got it wrong. Not that we got it wrong, but the court changed. But in fact, it's actually worse. Because what Barrett and Kavanaugh did is rather than... So they were pointing a gun at the Fifth Circuit, and it's a pattern. We talked about this with the mifepristone case, that's the abortion drug. We've talked about it with the tranny cases. They're screwing with a lot of what the Fifth Circuit is doing against these liberal district court judges. But this is a little bit of conjecture I'm throwing in, but reading Barrett's language and watching the swift response of the Fifth Circuit, this is what I'm reading into. And here's, as amidst the bad news and insidious news, there is a little bit of good news. And this is important. Just like we talk about the need to pressure Republican elected officials, right? There's a need to pressure Republican judges. The left does this all the time, and they win that way. The courts are a joke as it relates to I've said this before, courts have a very vital function on certain civil and criminal cases that we need them. And they still, you know, where it's not racial or politically motivated, it's kind of a nerdy case. Generally, it's bipartisan and the system works. But where it implicates a broad-based racial or political issue, they are no less political than the political branches, except we just say that their decisions are more immutable. And that's a problem. Okay? So when it comes to that, the left has been pressuring them forever. Now, as I've noted, because of that, they don't want to be viewed as siding with conservatives too often, even though the statute and constitution would dictate that they must, based on just these cases. So instead, they side a lot with the left, but they try to do it gently. But what's happened is people like myself, I think, and others have called them out enough and have shown their hypocrisy that they're starting to like, whoa, okay, immigration's a really volatile issue. We can't be seen as pointing a gun at the Fifth Circuit. So what Barrett did was just said, all right, fine. I'm going to load the gun, hand it to the Fifth Circuit and say, you'll point it at yourself. And that's exactly what they did. And I've spoken to people in the know, and it's very clear that when a Supreme Court writes that language, it's basically an order that, dude, you better do this or we're going to overturn you. So it's the exact opposite of what a lot of people thought yesterday, and the swift response of the Fifth Circuit overturning itself is proof of that. And this is extremely dangerous. You cannot imagine how problematic Barrett and Kavanaugh are. They are just as bad as Roberts. We swore up and down we weren't going to get another Roberts, and we did it. This is really bad. And let's not forget, this is coming on the heels of Barrett screwing us on Texas's barriers, putting an injunction on that. Okay, similar, you know, again, a little different procedures and whatever, and the issues, the underlying issues there with property rights and whatever. But the point is, same thing. District court goes after Texas, Fifth Circuit sides with Texas, Supreme Court sides with district court against Texas and the Fifth Circuit. And this is a continuing pattern while they allow bad liberal circuits to create insane rights and precedents unmolested by Supreme Court oversight and intervention. So this is a big problem, but it also opens the door. So first of all, I mean, number one, all the more so, we have to have a budget fight, which we're not going to have, and we must affirm the overturn that basically with states, they need to overturn Arizona v. U.S. Okay? Arizona v. U.S. Remember, even if you go along with judicial supremacism on constitutional interpretation, the courts are not saying that there's a constitutional right to immigrate. Now, they might create that. But until now, what they're just saying that statutorily, federal immigration law preempts state laws. So if Congress would, you know, if the Republicans in the House would say no DHS funding unless we affirm states have complete control and they can't do less, but they could do more. In other words, you don't want to bless sanctuary cities, but you know, they could totally do that, and that would get around Arizona v. U.S. and that's needed. But moreover, I have had a long-standing thesis about the courts that's similar to the political branches. Just like with the courts, just like with the political branches, I always say if you have people get on Greg Abbott's case, Kristi Noem's case, Henry McMaster's case, heck, Donald Trump's case, that this is unacceptable, typically they will at least sometimes begrudgingly, sometimes more robustly, sometimes, you know, slower, sometimes quicker, they will move to the right. Judges are no different. Let me tell you a secret. Judges don't like Google News being able to pull up The Blaze, Daniel Horowitz, Breitbart, The Federalist, National Review, whatever, saying Judge so-and-so, GOP appointee, is being hypocritical and siding with the left on everything in terms of process and law, and there's something really wrong with that person. They don't like that, okay? I'm just telling you, there's a reason why Chuck Schumer laid out a warning. It's the same thing we need to do. You can't, like, I would love to have a legal discussion without being rude, but we can't unilaterally disarm. And the reality is, judicial supremacism is a house of cards. They have neither force nor will. The reason why they screw with red states is because they know they're screwable. They know that they'll listen. But if you have an issue that is getting very volatile, like there's a limit to what Texas could not do already, it's getting so bad. That's why, in some ways, Barrett and Kavanaugh backed off. Now, in the end, they actually did something worse. They got the Fifth Circuit to themselves agree to take it off. But why did they do that? What likely happened was, and again, this is all conjecture, but, you know, Thomas and maybe some of the better ones are like, what the heck? You're sitting and doing this. I mean, you know, everything going on in Texas. They're like, all right, fine, okay. And that was their game. Remember, you're never going to win 6-3 on these issues. If you see a 6-3 ruling that seems to be in our favor, it's not. But what it does demonstrate is that they don't want to, if the states, if there's even a perception that, and they're, do you think they don't read the news, Republican media, that more and more people are saying, defy the court, okay, you know, that whole Shelby Park thing, because we already went through this with Barrett, with the Constantino Wire case. So, remember, they understand that if 20 red states got together and it was like, this has got to stop, they smartly give the legal case for states repelling an invasion, we're going to enforce this, this is done, we all pass SB4, and really much better, criminalize illegal immigration presence in the state, ban everything, and done, we are serious about this, they're going to think twice about screwing with it. I'm just going to tell you. And the left does this all the time. Let me give you the perfect example. I go back to COVID. Okay? Even some of the liberal judges would have to admit, in a normal time, the stuff the states were doing were insane. Was insane. I mean, I know they love tyranny, but, you know, they don't like all forms of tyranny because they like ruling with the ACLU on some things. And they don't like states having such crazy power. States were literally blocking travel from other states, which, as I've noted before, is something that even under the Articles of Confederation, where states were at the pinnacle of their power, they couldn't do. It's utterly insane. But for better or for worse, public opinion does influence the courts, just so you know. If it's clear, like you have some sort of, I'm just saying, illegals would come across, let's say, and you'd have 100 Lake and Rileys. Like, you'd have almost like a October 7th Hamas-style attack. Let's just say something like that would happen. And finally, like, the states, even the stupid Republicans, like, okay, it's got to end. I could promise you the Supreme Court's not going to be like, wow, that's a federal preemption. No. It ain't. You know what I mean? It's that goes out the window. And that's sort of what COVID was for the worse. The public panicked, both Republicans and Democrats. The people themselves were the problem, let's face it, at least initially. And it was like, oh my gosh, we're going to die, we have to do this. It was abundantly clear the courts were not going to screw with it. And they didn't. It was all public opinion. Okay? So, the lesson, before we move on, number one, we need a budget fight. We're not going to get it. And all the more so, yesterday proves the imperative for not just Abbott to keep to do what needs to be done, but for every Freedom Caucus needs to call for a special session, the ones that are already at a session, the ones that are in session, to hold up the budget, because that's usually what they do at the end of the session, until we pass state enforcement. Okay, that needs to be done. Now, it would be best to have the budget bill, the House Republicans, to bless it explicitly at a federal level. But that is what needs to be done on this issue if we're ever going to solve this issue. And if we're ever going to maintain red state sovereignty, this is what needs to happen. In other words, there's a difference between one state sheepishly acting like a thief in the middle of the night, like, I don't think we really have the power, but I got to show my people I'm doing something, so we'll pass that to the legislature. Oh, okay, you put an injunction. Okay, I'm sorry. Versus 20 Republican governors holding a press conference and giving the political, legal policy case that as a nation, we can't let this go on. Legally, here's the authority, and done, we're doing it. The more you give the impression you're going to hold your ground, the more this ends. And this is why I've always said delegitimizing judicial supremacism in and of itself in the body politic is important. Again, it's not that courts don't have a role, and even sometimes on things that could be very political. But you cannot say on issues affecting the whole of the people, as Lincoln said at his inaugural address, that they are the sole and final expositor of politics. That, I mean, that's worse than King George. That makes no sense. We've proved that, you know, 100 ways from Sunday. But then there's another action item in the way states assert their political and legal arguments, and that is to use public health. I hinted at this yesterday, and I want to talk a little bit in more detail about this. Because, wait a minute, you mean to tell me, again, this is all on the injunctive level, administrative stays, but let's be clear. The district court was pretty clear, and it is now pretty clear we will lose, not just, the Supreme Court won't even have to screw with us. Even the Fifth Circuit will screw. We will likely get a 2-1 ruling against us on the merits of state enforcement. Okay, that's pretty clear. Supreme Court's never going to overturn U.S. v. Arizona. Just going to tell. I mean, not through the front door. Not unless we do what I'm saying. Get stronger. If we just beg them, oh, okay, now's the time. Could we, you know, maybe you want to look at that again. Actually, no, we're not. It's all the attitude of the states. This is Federalist 46. Madison says the states get together, the disquietude of the people. We're not doing this. That's a different story. One of the ways to do this, again, pointing out in the court of public opinion, Greg Abbott stationed state troopers to block residents of Louisiana at checkpoints in March 2020 from coming in. We were told because of public health, there is nothing a state can't do. There's nothing beyond a state's police powers over public health affirmed in the stupid Jacobson v. Massachusetts 1902 opinion that Kavanaugh and Barrett continued to legitimize and uphold throughout the time. Again, remember, the few times we got positive rulings was just on the federal overreach, but fundamentally that a state could do it. And that's why, you know, if you look I'm trying to remember which case was this, New York or New Jersey. It was New York on their vaccine mandates, denying it even religious exemptions. Remember that it was 6-3. They decided not to take up the appeal from the nurses, the healthcare workers. It was only, again, Thomas Gorsuch and Alito. So this is a pattern. These same dogs who are like, no, it can't keep. So wait, you need to tell me, we have people, not just from 150 countries, but particularly most concentrated from the countries that have the most communicable disease outbreaks that are not just outbreaks, but endemic to their nation. And then now we have evidence it's actually in the country. Okay, this is open source. And somehow you're telling me the same state that was able to gag the mouths of their residents, shut down their churches, businesses, and all human lived experience events, funerals, you name it. Body, you can't get public accommodations unless you get a jab. I mean, literally kicking people out of restaurants. And then, of course, you could put a travel ban on other Americans, but you can't put a travel ban for public health on people coming from cholera, typhoid-ridden Haiti and malaria-ridden West Africa. West Africa has everything. Venezuela. When we have this now showing up. So I'm going to give you a little bit of the open source evidence, but there's a lot more where it came from. Because we all know that it's standard of living and sanitation that drives a lot of this. So you bring in these people, millions of them. What do you think you're going to get? And this entire edifice of public health suddenly goes silent. So states need to assert with more specificity the public health powers to keep them out. That needs to be part of the legislation and part of their legal and political defense. So, some of you might have seen, we're now up to 15 reported measles cases emanating from a migrant shelter in Chicago. And the media is going nuts about this. And the CDC is going nuts. And they want to blame Latipo for talking down vaccines. Because he had a few cases in Florida, but it's not as many as you have in Illinois and California and other places. Nothing to do with that. So they want to make it about vaccines. Now, first of all, let's just indulge that for a minute. Let's just agree with them for a minute. So the 8 USC 1182 A1A actually says any alien who has failed to present documentation of having received vaccination against vaccine-preventable diseases, which shall include at least the following diseases: mumps, measles, rubella, polio, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, influenza type B, and hepatitis B, and any other vaccinations against vaccine-preventable diseases, is inadmissible. Do you mean to tell me that we have documentation of millions of people from Haiti, Cuba, Central America, Venezuela, and every crapistan third world country around the world, Africa, you name it? No, we don't. So that right away is a violation of federal law, whether you agree with that law or not. But, you know, we always enforce it on legal immigrants and Americans. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And why can't states say, wait a minute, you know, again, we're told that states have an even more robust police power over public health. So fine, you want to tell me they can't enforce immigration law, but it should be no worse than denying entry to residents of other states and quarantining Americans. Like, wait a minute, you can't come here. Okay? And by the way, this is not just an aberration. CBS reports that the most measles infections we have experienced over the last few years were from, quote, low immunity among the thousands of evacuees airlifted from Afghanistan in 2022. I mean, this is out in the open. Okay? Obviously, the big one is tuberculosis. We've known that for years. The data is a few years old, but it's the same thing. The rate of TB among legal immigrants in America is 15.1 cases per 100,000. The TB rate, according to CDC, page 11 of a report they have in 2017, among Guatemalans, which is one of the big sending countries, is 106 per 100,000. Then, in other words, Guatemalans are 83 times more likely to have TB than Americans and 7 times more likely than legal immigrants. Last year, New York City Health Commissioner Ashwin Vasan explained, quote, many people who recently arrived in New York City have lived in or traveled through countries with high rates of TB. Whatever happened to this impervious public health juggernaut, huh? I mean, you want to talk about anarcho-tyranny? Wow. Other diseases such as leprosy, polio, and malaria are appearing in places like New York and Florida, coinciding with the wave. Leprosy is something we thought we were done with, but there's an MSN article on it. And by the way, generally they cover it up, but you could find it even in the media. They are mentioning that it is coming from the migrants. Ditto for syphilis, ditto for hepatitis B. It's funny, years ago I found in the Infectious Disease Society of America, there's a journal article that talked about the ethical concerns of the publication of results, which would lead to increased stigmatization and discrimination of undocumented persons because of tuberculosis. They talked about the need to cover up the reality that they all knew. But that was written a long time ago. See, now they've created such a public health, you know, Nazi hygiene sterilization regime that even the media is, you know, as much as they're kind of good at anarcho-tyranny, you know, tyranny for us, but anarchy for them, like illegals could do what they want. But to a certain extent, it's hard to fully shut off that faucet. So there is plenty of open source on this. You know, Europe experienced migration from Africa forever. WHO has warned, again, I'm going to have links to all this in an article coming up. As many as 50% of the world's migrants could be infected with TB. According to the UK's Public Health Laboratory, in each of the last 4 years, 95% of all new cases of Hep B came from abroad. According to the California Department of Health, they just put this out, more than 80% of TB cases are from foreigners. Since 2020, TB cases in California have increased 24%. Deaths are up 13%. And remember, they're coming from Central America, which is very endemic of these parasitic-borne diseases, and then even the ones that aren't from there, they come through the jungles of the Darien Gap where they're going to get all this stuff. I mean, you, again, if public health is your thing, you couldn't pick a worse problem than this, a worse sort of selection of migrants from countries of origin, and then the routes, like they're not coming from Canada. This is a quote from a CDC report, you know, like from 2017. Dengue, chikungunya, and Zika viruses cause mosquito-borne infections of increasing concern in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Dengue fever is endemic throughout much of Central and South America. Malaria, same thing. A recent study showed that more than 4% of migrants from Central and South America to Europe were sick with Chagas disease. People are also coming from Guinea, is a big African country we're getting from. They have a level 2 diphtheria outbreak, according to CDC. So yeah, how come this is not a thing? And remember, this is the disease angle. Then there's flatten the curve angle, the strain on the hospitals. We were told there's nothing a state can't do. Well, you know, the Yuma hospital director said that they spent $26 million on care for illegal aliens, including birthing mothers, neonatal care, emergency care in 2023. Manhattan claims they've spent $90 million, but that was before the big invasion. Be a lot more than that now. You're also having hundreds being taken to border hospitals for trauma care because they're jumping the fence and falling from the fence. But again, they're only doing that because of the incentives. If the states would demagnetize and say, you can't be here, they wouldn't come. And that would, remember the term, alleviate the pressure on the hospitals. How the hell are these same bastard Republican governors that made the arguments, some of them still in power, for the hospitals, for keeping out communicable diseases, here they won't make it. Folks, that's modern-day America. But anyway, I want to go on real quickly, just get to the other two items. Maybe we'll only have time for one. Okay, the budget bill. Not only does the budget bill fund everything for free, just everything you can imagine, it adds 12,000 special immigrant visas for Afghanistan, because we don't have enough Muslim immigration. We don't have enough third world immigration. They add more. I mean, these guys are just trolling us now. We let in about 100,000 when Biden had the evacuation. On top of another 100,000 we let in during the previous 20 years because of the war that we never had endemic to America, Afghans. You can't imagine what you're bringing into this country. The anti-Americanism, the anti-Semitism, the primitive treatment of women, I mean, you name it, Sharia law, but evidently we don't have enough of this in our streets. By the way, last night in Ohio, you had a cat fight between two Somali people in a Democrat primary, and one of them won and gave a speech in Somali, and his entire campaign was in Somali. This is in Columbus, which is the second largest Somali community. So this is, you know, I've noticed last few years, they're now getting political power. They're very bold. You have the raghead windbag, Gaza windbag women now at all these rallies sounding very obnoxious, openly chanting genocidal slogans against Americans and Jews. But yeah, I mean, this is what we brought in. So the GOP budget bill, but here's the game. Johnson had a slideshow he presented to his conference today saying, oh, it adds more ICE bed detention space and more border agents, more technology. You idiots! You idiots! It's not a funding issue. All that's going to go into parole. It's a policy issue. If you don't address the policies, I mean, it's unreal. Unreal. And then everything's just an Overton window thing. Like, oh, we're not funding UNRWA. But we won that bet already. European countries are not funding them because they're so implicated in October 7th. So instead, we're just funding Hamas directly through the Palestinians in Gaza. They're not cutting off Gaza aid. They're just not doing it through UNRWA. And then they're like, oh, we cut some funding to DEI. DEI is a policy. You have to ban the policy. You know, you cut the budget of DEI a little bit, you know, relative to its record high baseline, ain't going to do anything. We prevent banning gas stoves. Again, that was an Overton window thing. The left, what the left does is they do radical things and then they'll do something really catchy. Like, oh, you know, I think we might ban stoves. It's like a trial balloon. That's how you shift Overton window. We weren't doing that right now anyway. Eventually they will. But that's the sort of stuff that he says they had wins. We have the largest troop pay increase in 40 years. Man, what does that do for us in the military we have today? Again, no comment from Trump, nothing. And that just leaves me to the last issue, which is the primaries. And we have not, to this date, we have not knocked off a single incumbent. And overall, there's no evidence that we're getting better people in open seats. In fact, we're losing some Freedom Caucus guys like Dan Bishop. Now, I understand Dan is going to be Attorney General of North Carolina if he's able to win the general. And that's better than being in Congress. And that's what we need to be doing. But, you know, Mark Harris is not as good as him, not nearly as good. We're going backwards. But my biggest observation from last night is that Trump rules. Okay, all these guys, Trump is so powerful in the party. You're right, I'm agreeing with you. He's as powerful as Abraham Lincoln was within the Republican Party. So that's all the more of an indictment of the fact that he doesn't help us 90% of the time, and more often than he helps, he harms. Because last night, the results were perfectly commensurate with Trump. You know, Senate race, which, again, I don't begrudge that. I don't have a better, like I told you, there was no better candidate than Moreno. I just don't think he's what MAGA thinks, you know, he is. But it's not like we had a better option. Fine, whatever. He's got a lot of baggage. He'll needlessly struggle to win an Ohio seat. But whatever. We couldn't recruit a better candidate because MAGA, MAGA, MAGA. But anyway, that was billed as a close race, and he crushed it and won every single county. Which tells me that Trump's late rally had to have a lot to do with that. Okay? Likewise, there's two seats. District 9, around Toledo. It was a Democrat seat, but a very winnable Democrat seat. So it's kind of like an open seat. We had Craig Riedel versus Derek Marin. Riedel promised to join the Freedom Caucus. Marin did not. Marin had the support of the CLF, the Leadership Fund. Trump comes in last minute and endorses Marin because I think Riedel kind of privately supported DeSantis. So again, one of these deals where, you know, you don't get, so rather than getting a Freedom Caucus guy, we don't. And again, Riedel actually for once had a ton of money. He had a lot of money. Marin was severely outspent and Marin won. Again, that tells me the power of Trump's endorsement. It is very powerful. Okay? So Marin won there. Now, I know I'm getting, you know, from some people who live there on Twitter, say, Dan, you don't want to talk about it. I think Marin's more conservative. Marin's really... everyone's conservative. Everyone's conservative. Okay, but here's the deal. There's Uniparty and there's Freedom Caucus. Even a lot of the Freedom Caucus guys are pansies. So if you're not going to join the Freedom Caucus and you're getting funded specifically by CLF, even though Riedel was the default guy in the race, he was the first guy, he was actually recruited. And that's why Stefanik and McCarthy originally supported him, but then they withdrew their support when he said he joined the Freedom Caucus and supported DeSantis. So clearly, there's something going on there. Is it possible Marin could surprise us? It's possible. It almost never happens. When you don't say you're going to join the Freedom Caucus and you get CLF support against another challenger in a primary, you know, if you're the only one, so you get CLF support is one thing. Very rarely are you going to go up against leadership. So, yeah, in a perfect world with good leadership, I'm sure Marin would be a decent guy that's not moving the ball forward. And then in District 6, which is the one that's going to fill the special seat because Johnson selfishly retired to run to be a president of a university, that's on the eastern side of the state. You know, the guy that's being supported by the Rhino leadership, not even leadership, but the Main Street partnership, won over another guy who, Stolzfus, who was backed by Warren Davidson and was going to join the Freedom Caucus. So again, we lost that. And then we have the state legislature. There was the Blue 22. 22 House Republicans basically gave control of the House to Democrats. So it's not just that they, rebelled against us on issues, but they literally handed the chamber, almost on par with Texas, like rebelling against the essence of being a Republican, and they basically worked with them, okay? And they got a bad speaker. And by the way, the Republican option for a speaker was Derek Marin, ironically. So you would think Trump's endorsement of him would at least extend to, all right, well, go against the guys who opposed Marin, right? No. But it was all because to get rid of Riedel, because he would join the Freedom Caucus and he supported DeSantis. So, okay, we only get when Trump's intervention against people who attack him from the right, but not from the left. So imagine what would happen if you had Democrats get together and work with Republicans to undermine a Democrat speaker and basically pick a de facto, sharing partnership when you should have a supermajority. Not just a majority, but a supermajority. Well, you would say 100% of those people would have primary challengers, and really 100% would lose their election. Well, so there are 22 of them. Now, they have term limits there. 16 stood for election. 12 got challengers. Really, 16 should have, but when you don't have leadership with you, and you don't have Trump with you, and you're struggling, you couldn't even get, 4 of them won. We defeated 4. That's pretty abysmal for that. What's the difference between Ohio and Texas? Texas, we had Trump's endorsement. Here, we didn't. Now, he didn't endorse again. So he didn't get involved. But this is the point. He is the party. So we don't have another avenue to mobilize grassroots, even to the level of the Tea Party, because the establishment's the same way it is, and the grassroots are sucked up by Trump. So if you don't have Trump come in, we have no avenue to winning, and last night showed that. But if Trump does come in, you know, if those of you who think Moreno is really great, and Dolan certainly was an establishment guy, so I agree with you on that much, it helped. It carried the guy to a crushing victory. Let me give you one more example. You had one race of note in Illinois, Illinois 12. That's the southern part of the state. That's the most conservative part of the state, the reddest district. Okay, so last night proved it perfectly. You had a guy, typical establishment guy, Mike Bost, congressman. You have this guy, Darren Bailey, who was a state senator from that district, but he also was the last Republican gubernatorial nominee. And he had some money and he gained a lot of headlines. So when you have just a congressman versus a state senator who has a pretty large base within that congressional district, but then was also well known. So that's a little unique. That's almost like almost as even. Okay. And indeed, Bailey got like 48%. I mean, he came close. Now, I'm not so into that guy. That guy is like obsessed with Trump. But again, the irony of the movement is Matt Gaetz endorsed Bailey. Mary Miller, who's the only conservative from Illinois, endorsed Bailey against her own colleague. And Trump came in and endorsed Bost. Now, usually our guys get almost nothing. But again, remember, in this case, he was very well known, the challenger. He was the Republican nominee for governor, had a lot of notoriety, a lot of media about him, and he was a longstanding state senator from that district. So he Boss is from the western part. Bailey's from the eastern part. So he had a whole base of support there. 100%, we can conclude that without Trump's endorsement, we would have had our first incumbent go down. Now, we do have Texas 23. What's his name? Herrera, who is challenging Gonzalez in a runoff. But, you know, Dan Patrick is already supporting. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump supports Gonzalez. I'm going to try to get Herrera on the show one of these days. But so far, not a single incumbent has been knocked off. We are not advancing the ball in open seats. I can maybe make the case we're even going backwards. And even in the state legislatures, even something like voting against the Republican speaker, we could only get 4. Normally, we get nothing. But something that much, and again, most states you don't have that much of a rebellion where you literally have like Republicans in name only like that. They'll vote for the Republican speaker, but just screw us on the issues. So it's not like I could tell you we have a pathway to getting rid of. Now, to be fair, you don't have an organized Freedom Caucus there. Other states we do, and hopefully we'll be able to knock off people. But that is our only movement. Again, the degree of specificity of detail I've given over to you in terms of the courts, in terms of immigration policy, in terms of the budget, in terms of primaries. Nobody's doing this. Imagine if we had a movement doing this. Imagine where we would be. Just know it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. If you take top 30 shows, 30 voices, writers, influencers, and they have the content we have here, you would have a different party. You'd have different red states. You'd have a different movement. You'd have a different focus. It doesn't have to be this way. But it's going to continue. La, la, la. They're going to rape us on the budget. They're raping us in the primaries. Red state legislative sessions are a joke. I could get to all that. There's a bunch of news out of Idaho. They couldn't even pass school choice and couldn't pass a bill protecting against central digital bank currency. By the way, even to the extent we knocked off 4 incumbents in Ohio last night, it was largely driven by a school choice issue. So 2 things about that. Number one, remember, a lot of establishment guys are good on that issue, but screw us on a lot, you know, the other issues that are a lot more important and fatal to our survival. So they're not going to have that vulnerability. And also, we have a little bit of money behind that. We do have a movement. Again, you get what you fight for. I don't want to hear this. Everything's stolen. Everything's deep state. It's actually right in front of you. Proverbs 4:25. The path is in front of you. You see the problem. You see what you can do about it. But you like wandering off. And what happens? You turn your foot into evil. And that's what the movement is. But it doesn't have to be this way. There's a lot we can be doing within our own sphere of influence. And by the way, influencing Republican judges, both in terms of writing hit pieces on their opinions, which I'm going to continue doing, but also in terms of mobilizing the red states to start jousting with them. Yesterday's little rope-a-dope at the Supreme Court proved that once and for all. So a lot to unpack. Let me know your thoughts. Daniel Horowitz at startmail.com. But this is why I need you to send this show to everyone you know, because we need to elevate substance over grift. We need to elevate solutions and outcomes over fake inputs and memes and just nonsense, utter clamor. We can't afford this. This is not headed in a good direction on any front. Till tomorrow, Proverbs 4:25, and God bless y'all.